Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A Friday at the beginning of the month? Why, yes, indeed, this is a jobs day. We'll talk about that. It is also, and even better, National Donut Day, which we will soon tell you more about as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. The 6th of June, 2014 is where we are. It is a Friday. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. I'll give you three guesses where we're going to start today, and the first two don't count, all right? Donuts. That's where we're... No, I'm just kidding. We're going to go with jobs. The May unemployment report landed this morning, and it landed just about where everybody thought it was going to land. 217,000 new jobs. The unemployment rate held steady at 6.3%. We will digest that and the rest of the week's news economy-wise with Felix Salmon from Fusion and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello, Kai.
So, Felix, let me start with you and ask you for a gut check on the jobs report.
Exactly the same as it's been for the past couple of months. We're steady at just over 200,000 jobs a month. It's not spectacular. We're getting better. The economy is growing. It's not shrinking. It's no surprises.
Joe, what do you got?
You know, this maybe when the Fed starts to think more aggressively about raising those rates eventually, well, some analysts I talked to said maybe second quarter of next year. It's interesting, but saw wages rise about five cents.
Yep, wages are up
pretty
tad.
Good. Manufacturing jobs. Good.
Hey, Felix, really quickly, channel Janet Yellen for me.
She's going to continue doing what she said she was going to do, which is the taper. Yep. And she's going to get around to raising rates in her own sweet time. And she's not going to let these job reports derail that.
All right. We will detour to Europe. The European Central Bank, Joe, yesterday, I guess it was, pushed interest rates way down. Bank deposits overnight at the ECB are negative now. How big a deal is that? Much hay was made, Kai.
And what's interesting is this is the first major bank to do this in recent history, recent memory. And basically, this could be an opportunity for small and medium businesses in Europe, you know, pushing the money into their hands. Maybe they can hire some more. It could be good for U.S. Companies like Boeing and big companies like that do big business with Europe.
Felix, why does it matter for us here other than the big company?
Well, the idea is that they're trying to bring down the value of the euro, which will increase their exports. And I guess in a zero-sum game, that's bad for the U.S. rather than good for the U.S. But what we want more than anything else is a healthy Europe. And if this helps expand Europe, if it helps give them inflation, then that's a good thing for us. Also, by the way, you have to mention the important thing they did was this thing called LTROs, not negative interest rate. They're pushing $400 billion into these small and medium-sized businesses in Spain and Italy and Greece.
Now, you know what I have to do now? I have to make you explain LTRO in 15 seconds or less because it's only a half-hour radio
show. It's a way of lending money very cheaply to banks so that they can lend it on to the people who need it.
All right. Fair enough. Joe, let's stay with Europe for a second. 6 months ago, we were all talking about how amazing it was that Europe had kind of come back, right? The debt crisis seemed to be over. Nobody was talking about breaking up the eurozone anymore. They weren't talking about getting rid of the euro. And now, all of a sudden, Europe's in a big problem again. We're worried about deflation. Hello?
Yeah, that is definitely a concern. But if you look at what happened with the ECB, markets rallying in Europe on the news, U.S. responding relatively positively. So for now, it seems relatively okay, but still very much many infrastructural concerns across the board.
Did we get complacent, do you think, Joe, about Europe?
I think some people would say yes, while some people would say no. But I think looking at where it is now, they're trying to do something. With the ECB trying to take a little bit more aggressive action.
Yeah. Felix, talk to me for a second, and I know this is your favorite topic, talk to me for a second about the stock market. I don't care about the highs. I don't care about the lows. What I want you to talk to me about is volume and how thin it's been and why that matters.
We have very low volume and we have very low volatility, the two different vols.
Yep.
And frankly, that would have been more of a worry 10 or 20 years ago. Today, so much of the trading is driven by these high-frequency trading shops, and high-frequency trading is going away. And if high-frequency trading is becoming less common, that's a good thing. It does mean lower volumes. It does mean lower volatility. But we don't need all of those algo bots in the market trading in and out 100 times a second.
We don't really. I thought that's what gave us liquidity, and that's That's what they all tell us. That's what they told Michael Lewis, right?
And he didn't exactly buy it either.
Yeah, no, I know. Joe, thoughts on the market? I mean, it's you know, highs and lows don't much matter, right?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is, you know, when the VIX is down, volatility is low, no fear, badness, maybe you could see a little bit of that coming through. But what I think is so interesting is a lack of participation when the volume is thin. Does that mean the gains will last? We're approaching 17,000 today. Yeah. Something to watch, something to think about.
They won't. Right. It's too quiet, Kai. It's too quiet.
It's really
sell in
quiet.
May and whatever. Anyway, Felix Salmon from Fusion and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
All right. On Wall Street today, as it happens, there was a little something going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Should you happen to be a resident of the great state of New Jersey and be in the market for a new high-end automobile, there is at least one brand-name car you cannot buy there. You can go to a Tesla showroom in New Jersey, sure, but only to look, because for the past 6 weeks or so, Tesla hasn't been allowed to sell at its two company-owned stores there because of a state law that requires new vehicles be sold through dealer franchises. There is a bill making its way through the State House in Trenton that would change all that and let companies that sell only electric cars, say, yes, Tesla, to sell it to the public. It is, as it turns out, all about repairs, as Dan Bobkoff explains.
Yaina Moore of Princeton has long driven fast cars like Porsches and BMWs. 9 months ago, she switched to a Tesla.
You just put your foot down and it goes.
And part of the appeal for Moore was that the Tesla doesn't need oil changes or new spark plugs.
Has few moving parts from which to have failure.
And this is one of Tesla's big arguments for why it should be able to sell its cars directly. Most car dealers make very little profit on new cars, maybe 1 or 2% of the price. The National Automobile Dealers Association says more than half of dealers' profits come from service, parts, and used cars. Tesla says its cars don't need much service, so it wants to make its profits on the sales.
What we have done in New Jersey is made it illegal for them to use their business model to sell cars.
New Jersey Assemblyman Tim Eustace co-sponsored the bill to allow electric car companies to sell directly. Tesla wouldn't comment on tape, but the company is called dealers middlemen. Dealers, of course, see it differently.
The Tesla business model is designed specifically to eliminate price competition.
Jim Appleton is president of the New Jersey Coalition of Automotive Retailers, and he says most new cars don't need much maintenance anyway.
Tesla may know a lot about electric cars, but apparently they don't know much about internal combustion engine cars anymore.
And for what it's worth, Tesla does offer service plans. Prepaying $1,900 gets you 4 years of service. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
As I said up at the top of the broadcast, happy National Donut Day, everybody. That's what the first Friday in June is, don't you know? Has been since 1938 when the Salvation Army first declared it to be so. Started as a donut-themed fundraising event for low-income mothers during the Depression. And as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark explains from the Wealth and Poverty Desk, that is not the only bit of economics baked into those little toroidally shaped treats.
A toroid is the fancy name for the shape of a donut, full on the outside edges and hollow in the middle, which is kind of the shape of our economy these days. Middle-class jobs are hollowing out, but there's plenty of growth at the low and high ends of the income spectrum. And in fact, the donut shop economy seems to be following suit.
So that is $37.75, and could I get your name, please?
$37.75 for one dozen donuts and a cup of coffee. We're at Donut Friend, a new vegan-friendly, custom-made donut shop in Los Angeles. Jana Maresch, who works at a local university, is here to pick up some donuts for her office. The fancy ones go for $6 a piece.
I mean, there's one where it's just like a crown of bacon, and that's totally worth it. It is. My team will be very happy today.
Pastry is an incredibly flexible medium.
Paul Mullins is an anthropologist and author of Glazed America, A History of the Donut. He says, like cupcakes and now toast, there's just something about baked goods that makes them easy to cater to high and low income customers.
You know, I don't know if my donut really needs to have a philosophy, but there's clearly a place in the market for these kinds of gourmet foods.
There's clearly still a place for ungourmet donuts, too, though, according to the line out the door of Monterey Donut, a cash-only lottery ticket-selling donut shop a few miles from Donut Friend.
Amigo, 1.25. Yeah, gracias.
Lee Pai, originally from Cambodia, is selling a glazed donut to a construction worker who she speaks to in Spanish. She learned Spanish and English.
From my customer.
The average donut here, 75 cents. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
We've been talking about numbers a lot on the program this week, more than we usually do, that is, as we've aired some pieces from our road show that we've been doing. It's called How We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. Anyway, I wanted to get some feedback from you on the air. What numbers matter to you? What indicators do you use to tell you what's happening in the economy? First up, Brian Wood from Van Nuys, California.
The economic indicator that rules my life is the oddity of the change I get at retail establishments. I noticed in 2009 when the economy went sour, I got a lot more silver dollars, bicentennial quarters, $2 bills. It appears that when things go bad, formerly collectible money becomes spending money.
We did a story not too long ago about shopping catalogs and why they are still showing up in our mailboxes in this digital age. Short answer, because companies are still somehow making money from them. Fine, great. But then Restoration Hardware happened. This year's catalog is actually 11 individual books bound together in shrink wrap plastic, 3,000 plus pages, and saving best for last. It's part of the company's strategy to reduce waste. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
I'm holding one of these things right now, and to call it a catalog is a bit of an understatement. The phrase bend at the knees comes to mind. In fact, the company has come up with many other names for it, including Magalog, Sourcebook, and Inspiration File.
I think the average phone book weighs 3 pounds. This weighs about 16 pounds.
Brian McGough is managing director of retail at Hedgeye. He says most retailers put out catalogs quarterly or monthly, but because Restoration Hardware puts out its Gargantulog once a year, it actually produces less paper than many of its competitors.
Williams-Sonoma, who no one ever talks about them in their catalogs, they print 3 times as many pages annually.
Restoration Hardware CEO Greg Friedman says the company used to ship smaller catalogs 10 times per year, but by moving to the one megalog, it's gotten higher sales for fewer pages.
And additionally, we ship all of our Sourcebook titles bundled together versus separately, which is also significantly more efficient.
Friedman says the company is applying the same strategy to its stores, closing many of them and moving to fewer but larger locations.
They're really trying to create this sense of faux authenticity.
Kit Yarrow is a professor of business at Golden State University. She says Restoration Hardware takes its design cues from antiques and produces so many of them that only about 20% can fit in a store. The only place big enough to show them all is its catalog and website, which accounts for nearly half of all sales. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up.
When I was in my 20s and trying to write my first novel, I thought it would change my life. I believed if I could sell my first novel, my life would completely, completely change.
Author Mona Simpson took a while, but she did all right. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lifted 88 points on this jobs Friday. That's 0.5%, closed at 16,924. The NASDAQ up 25.6%, 43.21, while the S&P 500 popped up 9 points. That's 0.5%. 1949. There for the week, the Dow up 1.2%, the NASDAQ up 1.9%, the S&P 500 rose 1.3%. Verizon inched up 0.2%. Today, as investors reacted to the news that the company's war of words with Netflix is heating up, Netflix nudged up 0.4%. They're arguing about bandwidth, by the way, and who's using more of it. Donut sellers were on a sugar high thanks to National Donut Day today. Me too, I had 2 of them. Dunkin' Brands frosted up 0.5% today. Krispy Kreme baked in a gain of 0.8%. Hertz Global Holdings tumbled 9% after the company said it would restate financial results for the past 3 years to correct accounting errors. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.59%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the House Veterans Affairs Committee holds an oversight hearing on data manipulation and access to VA health care. Actress Natalie Portman turns 33. And musician, inventor, and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee Les Paul was born on June 9, 1915. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Earlier this year, brothers Joe and Anthony Russo directed a little movie you might have heard of. It's called Captain America, The Winter Soldier. Yeah, it did pretty well at the box office, that one did. Well enough for them to get the gig directing the next installment, too. But in the meanwhile, they are going to have some spare time on their hands. So they've branched out a bit. They have started a new company to make what is colloquially known as branded entertainment. The company is called Bullet, after the Steve McQueen movie of the same name, which was, if you think about it for just a second, one big long ad basically for the Ford Mustang. Guys, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
Of course. Thanks for having us.
It would seem that you guys are, I guess, bankable is the Hollywood phrase right now. What with Captain America, you got the next one coming out. Why start this company? Anthony?
We sort of fell into commercials years ago after we won the Emmy for directing the pilot for Arrested Development.
Yeah.
It was sort of easy work that we could kind of supplement our income with. But, you know, we kept shooting, and I think over the past decade, we kind of fell in love with, like, the creative possibilities that you have shooting commercials. It's like it's not as big of a commitment as a movie or a TV show, which can take a few years. You can be more experimental with equipment or people you're collaborating with, and ideas you're trying. And we sort of that's, I think, what sort of first got our energy going in the commercial field.
You know, it occurs to me I saw one of these the other day without knowing that it was you guys. It was a vodka ad with that woman from Mad Men whose name I can't remember. Allison Brie, who plays Pete Campbell's wife on Mad Men. Mm-hmm. She and some guy are in a vodka store or something, right?
Yeah.
And it was a 30-second gig. But I later found out, researching, talking to you guys, it was part of a 3-minute longer thing that you guys put together.
Well, that spot was actually a very interesting experience for us because, again, like I said, we've been shooting commercials for years. Usually when you shoot commercials, you shoot the 30-second spot or the 60-second spot. And if you get some bonus material that can be cut into a longer piece for the internet, that's a great bonus.
Yeah.
This spot was the opposite. What we shot was the 3 to 4 minute piece for the internet, and the bonus was the 30 second spots that they could cut out of it. So it's like, it was just very indicative on a personal level to like where the industry is moving.
And where, Joe, does something like that run? The 30 obviously runs on TV. What do you do with that 3.5 minute thing?
Well, it goes on the internet. They find ways for people to link to it. They get a lot of press for it because it's Allison Brie and Adam Scott.
Yeah.
It's the viral space,
right?
You're trying to exist in that space where, you're generating interest because it's funny or it's cute or it's entertaining or, you know, it's that 2 to 3 minutes that can fill your day at the office.
Hopes they can fill my day at the office with 2 or 3 minute spots. Vodka ads are great, and Allison Brie is fun, and Harley Davidson, which you guys have done, and there's BMW. What do you do, though, when, I don't know, some floor wax company comes to you and says, we want you guys to make a 3.5 minute thing on floor wax? Do you take the job or do you roll your eyes? Anthony, what do you think?
I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, like, really, at the, you know, it's all about what you can you do creatively. If you can think of a crazy idea that they're into and that excites you as a filmmaker, then yeah.
Huh.
Here's where the radical shift is coming in this business, right? Electronic home video downloading services like Netflix. These are non-advertiser based services, right? So the brands are going to have to find new ways to reach eyeballs and their consumers. And that's why we call the company a branded content company, because at the end of the day, the only way they're going to be able to do that is through narrative. You could say that, Kurt Sutter's show on FX is
Sons of Anarchy
is a credible commercial for Harley Davidson.
There's another word for this that people are going to be thinking of as they hear it: product placement. How is it the same, different? Compare, contrast, somebody.
Product placement is, because we did comedic shows, we had a very well-known episode of Arrested Development he did where I think it was Carl Weathers and David Cross go to Burger King, right?
Yep.
Because the show was a low-rating show. We needed to supplement the show with external
revenue,
monetization, revenue. Exactly. So
yeah.
We made a joke out of it, right? Had them talking about, how good the food was at Burger King while they were also discussing a scene. There is a way to do, and Sons of Anarchy is an example, product placement that integrates into narrative in a way that it's seamless, and you have no idea that the product is in there. You know, it's subconsciously associated with how you feel about the show, which is great for the brand.
Yeah.
But moving forward, we think that is the future.
This is going to sound like I'm tweaking you a little bit, and I'm really not. But I wonder whether you guys feel like you're selling out, going from Captain America, which I get as a commercial property, to chilling for vodka.
Look, we've never looked at it that way. Again, this is the kind of company that can be very discerning about what work we take.
You know, look, at the end of the day, it's called show business, right? There is a extreme stress on the word business. And money to create projects comes from many, many different areas. Say that this FX said, you know what, we're not going to make Sons of Anarchy. It's too expensive, right?
Yeah.
And Kurt went to Harley and he said, listen, you spend, $10 million on an international commercial, one international commercial to get you 3 weeks of airtime. Why don't you give that $10 million to me, and I'll give you a season's worth of content with your motorcycles in it. And then we get a great show in Sons of Anarchy. So it's finding new ways to use money to advance creativity.
Joe and Anthony Russo, you know them best from the most recent Captain America movie, and now their new company, too. It's called Bullet, a branded entertainment company. Guys, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right, your turn once again to tell us what numbers you use to keep an eye on the economy.
Hi, my name is Dawn. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the number that matters to me most is, as an hourly consultant, my variable paycheck.
Here's the thing about numbers, economic numbers anyway. You got to put them in context. In context in the economy, of course, but also in our culture, or all you've got is statistics. So to wrap up our author series today, people who are in the business of words, author Mona Simpson.
It works for me when I really know the characters, when I've thought of much more about their lives and much more time in their lives than even comes into the novel. What kind of a household is it in terms of money, in terms of future? Is it a family that values a long term or a very short horizon? When I was in my 20s and trying to write my first novel, I thought it would change my life. I believed if I could sell my first novel, my life would completely, completely change. And I spent 5 years supporting myself, you know, sort of hand to mouth with part-time jobs as my student loans were coming due and my socks were wearing out. You know, when I went to a party, I wore the same dress for years that my mom had bought me on a visit. And then I did sell the novel. The first offer the publishing company made for it was $10,000, and my agent said, well, she has a lot of student loans, so they got up to $12,500. And if you hear those numbers, you think, well, amortize that by 5 years. It's not very much money. And yet, publishing my first novel did change my life in many more ways than money. I got a letter recently from a middle schooler asking me, she had about 10 questions asking about, she said she was interested in the writer/author profession. But one of her questions was, do you make a lot of money? And the answer is, you know, no. I mean, novels take me 4 or 5 years, sometimes 10 at the most, sometimes 3 at the least. And if you amortize the money fiction writers earn from them, we're not CEOs. We're not hugely successful in that way. But on the other hand, by the time you're doing it, you've realized the real economy, which is time, and that you're spending most of your life making something that you find beautiful and that's deeply satisfying and fulfilling. And, you know, in a way, love is the real economy. If you're spending your time, which is really the scarcest commodity there is, if you're spending that doing something that gives you a lot back, that's a kind of wealth.
Mona Simpson's newest book is called Casebook. You can read an excerpt of it at our website. And you can read today's Numbers Week guest blog from our Friday regular and Financial Times editor, Cardiff Garcia. His number, 3.5 million. Why? Oh, you got to go look. Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, an observation or two about our through line this week, riffing off the live show we're taking on tour this summer and fall, how we learn to stop worrying and love the numbers. There is, in point of fact, a whole lot to worry about with economic numbers. A, they can be really boring. Two, they can be cherry-picked to suit one side or the other. And three, or C, there are just so many of them your head can spin, really. But they matter. They matter a lot in a lot of things, so you kind of have to learn to love them. All right, that's it. All the stories from this week are online at marketplace.org. And if you want to see what we look like on stage or, you know, just in regular life, we've got a bit of video from our Washington show about 6 weeks ago. It's up on our website as well. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Friday. Today, the Dow up 88 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 25.6%. The S&P 500 popped up 9 points. That is 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. It is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a really good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.